from the Duck South Studios in Morgan City, Mississippi.
I love the smell of napalm in the morning.
I want to punch you in the face so bad right now.
This is the On the X podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.
I didn't get a harumph out of that guy.
Get the governor a harumph.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
Today's episode is brought to you by Advantage Multi from Bayer. Advantage Multi is veterinarians' number one choice in the prevention of heartworms, fleas, roundworms, hookworms, and whipworms. Treats and controls sarcoptic mange. Make sure your dog is protected by using Advantage Multi.
I said what I said and I'll stand by it to the death.
Ladies and gentlemen, can I please have your attention?
And now, here are your hosts, J. Paul Jackson.
You just love to hear yourself talk, don't you? Even when you're not saying anything.
Rocky LaFleur.
Yo, Adrian! Adrian!
Houston Kennedy.
Please, Houston, we have a problem.
And Josh Webb.
Coons! Well, raccoon's trying to get on our back porch. Mama just chased him off with a broom.
Welcome to the Sunday afternoon edition of the On the X podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com. I'm J. Paul Jackson, and today I'm in the studios here in Morgan City, Mississippi, with co-hosts Josh Webb and Rocky LaFleur. I want to remind you guys that today's edition of the On the X podcast is brought to you by Hardcore Brands and Hardcore Decoys, makers of the most functional and innovative products out there for the serious waterfowler. We know it's not easy being hardcore. Guys, man, it's so great to be here today. What's happening?
How have you been, J-Paul? I've been on the road for the last two or three days, so I'm just kind of trying to wind down myself. Has it been busy over your way?
Oh, man, it's been unbelievable. We've been dog kennels full of dogs right now, trying to get everything ready for duck season down at the Duck Club. And, you know, just the preseason preparation that we start by planning way ahead. And, you know, earlier this week, I also had to run down to Oxford, Mississippi. And while I was there, I stopped by Oxford Square Apartments where our buddy Rocky Royan have a couple of units there. And I was amazed when I pulled up in front of one of Rocky's units to find that Rocky had started a new business. Rocky,
what's that?
It's Rocky's Remodeling and Bed Bug Extermination. Won't you tell
us? I did not know he was into that business now.
Apparently
oh
so.
My gosh. Yeah, I had some bad renters on some rental property in Oxford. It didn't turn out well. Walked into the condo after they moved out, and let's just say it was in bad need of being fixed back up and a bad need of for extermination of insects and pests that were in it. It was all. It was really bad. I mean, usually when I have to go in and fix one of these condos back up, I usually just have to, you know, just refresh the paint on the walls and the ceiling, and not this time. I mean, I had to put two or three coats of paint on the wall. I mean, it was two or three coats on the ceiling. These people were gross nasty. So anybody with rental property understands that.
Yeah, so what you're saying is the deposit didn't touch paint.
Oh, no. It's going to end up being about $1,000 over what the deposit was. Josh, you ever had any experience with any bed bugs?
No, and I never planned to.
Look, I've heard of bed bugs. How the heck do you get bed bugs in an apartment?
Yeah, I don't get that. Unless they were renting it out themselves on the weekend.
I don't know, but they've treated it twice, and it's still bugs crawling around. I'm going to have to get it treated again.
That
so,
sounds
anyway.
Awful.
What are you going to do to get rid of that strong odor of curry that you smell as soon as you walk in the door?
I really don't know. Can we change the subject? I've actually enjoyed my weekend not thinking about it.
Well, you did a really good job painting the walls and everything. You know, the smell may still be there, and you may not have been able to use the sheets as drop cloths because of the insects in them, but I got to say, I was impressed with your painting skills It was a talent I just flat out didn't know you had. So, you know, guys, in Oxford, Mississippi, if you need help, remember, Rocky's Remodeling and Extermination Services.
Gosh. All right, let's move on to something serious. All right, who's seen the story about the Bomars, Josh and Sarah Bomar?
I've seen it and read up on it.
I'll kind of summarize it for those that haven't heard about it. Josh Bomar was a champion athlete, champion javelin thrower in college, and Josh decided that he was going to not bow hunt a bear or rifle hunt a bear. He decided he wanted to spear a bear, and he got his wife Sarah to film this for him. And anyway, he practiced for months upon months. He ended up spearing a bear and uploaded it to YouTube. The world has gone crazy over this video the past few weeks, and it's made all the news scenes, and it's been pretty rough on them.
Yeah, I mean, it's sweeping the nation, or sweeping the world, really. But, you know, I think it's, unfortunately, you know, we have to be really, really careful as hunters as to what we put out there, you know. But in the same light, if it's legal and ethical, you know, you have to support your fellow hunters, you know, whether it's something you would personally do or not. And, you know, I just think that the media finds things that they can hold on to, attach themselves to. And it's been really unfortunate for him and the way that they've been treated by so many people. But at the same time, I see so many hunters, you know, surrounding them and supporting them. But it's just, you know, I think you have to be careful with what you, you know, release. In a lot of ways, it's unfortunate because we, as hunters, we're proud of what we do, not just the harvesting of an animal. We're proud of being able to go out there and do it. It's just, it's tough to see somebody treated the way that they've been treated over, you know, something that he did legally and ethically.
Yeah, you know, I've got a couple of different observations here. I've seen part of the video, and I've read, I think, an article in the Washington Post. Maybe Houston can throw that up on the website for our folks, too. But, you know, this guy, he threw the javelin in college, which is a spear. We have primitive weapons hunting all around the country, you know, special seasons for that, because Game and Fish knows that, you know, not everyone is going to bow hunt. Not everyone is going to use a muzzle loader. Certainly not everyone is going to use a spear, particularly for a black bear, because that was a very large bear if you watch the video. And I happen to have killed, about 10 years ago, I had the good fortune of killing a huge chocolate bear up in Canada, and I shot it at 11 yards. That's pretty doggone scary. So, you know, and I shot it with a rifle. I mean, this guy is at the same distance doing it with a spear. He got a great hit on the bear. It only went 160 feet. Yeah, personally, I think it is shameful that people are on him at all. And it's, you know, people I feel like that are really uneducated about hunting and don't get it. And, you know, yeah, you definitely need to be careful what you put out there. But this guy, you know, he was proud of it. It was a goal. It was something that he wanted to do. I applaud him for that. I think that all of us in the hunting community ought to rally around the Bomars. And my second observation is, how impressive is it that this guy got his wife to film it? I mean, I've been on their YouTube channel and on their social media. She is a beautiful young lady and quite an accomplished hunter in her own right. And, you know, it's scary enough to stick a bear with a spear at 40 feet, but to have your wife standing a few feet behind you, and she's got the, you know, kahunas, if you will, to hang in there with you and film it. Personally, I thought the whole thing was pretty cool, and it's been blown way out of proportion. What do you think, Rocky?
Let me just throw this out there and see what you think. I think that for hunting is representative of our political culture. There's a small percentage on the right that believe in hunting. There's a small percentage on the left that are anti-hunters. There's a group in the middle that could go either way, depending on the day or what's happening. And the small percentage in the middle, or the percentage in the middle, they have an idea of hunting. And that idea of hunting is when you take an animal, it dies very gently. There's, you know, they just, they die a quickly, painlessly. And, but when you see the reality of something like this, and knowing, you know, one of the big headlines in all the newspapers and all the media outlets was the bear had to bleed out. Well, we know as deer hunters or any kind of big game hunter, an animal, when you shoot it with a bow or a gun, you let it bleed out, and then you don't push the animal and you go find it the next day. And I'm like, Josh, I think you got to really, really be careful about what you put in out there, because bear hunting, to me, the way it's done is a little iffy. And here's the reason why, because you're hunting over a barrel of garbage or a barrel of bait, and you can see that in the video. And then the way he celebrated it, you know, could be a little iffy. And the way, I guess, they presented the bear at the end, you could tell it was stiff overnight. And so I think I'm like Josh. I think you have to really, really be careful about what you're putting out there, because I think sometimes you can scare away more people that would be interested in hunting by what you put out there than, you know, and it just hurts sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, I'd have to agree with all that. But, you know, in the end, I mean, you stuck a bear with a spear at 40 feet. How cool is that? I mean, to me, if somebody has a problem with that, you know, screw them. I mean, I'm sorry. I'm not into this political correctness. I know that as hunters, we've got to be careful. We do not want to have those people in the middle, you know, that don't have a real idea of what we do or understanding, look at us in a negative way, that could have a long-term impact on our sport. But on the other hand, I think if you take a look at where these knee-jerk reactions to this stuff come from, I mean, in one article that I read, you know, there was somebody with the Canadian ministry in one of the larger cities in Canada that said, oh, you know, we need to take a look at this and maybe revisit whether or not we're going to allow hunting for bears with spears. Well, first of all, I mean, in that situation, that is the only way I can imagine the prey having a better chance of turning the tables on you would be if it were some wild African game or in North America, a grizzly bear. I mean, a big old black bear at 40 feet, particularly injured, is still dangerous as can be. And, you know, my point here is that the people that have that kind of reaction don't come from the center. They don't come from the center of our country. If you take a look at, you know, where the articles came from that were written about this, there was one in the Washington Post. There was one in the Los Angeles Times. There was one in the Chicago Tribune. And right there you have it. You know, people in Chicago, LA, and New York have no clue about our lives in the Delta of Mississippi or in rural Ohio where these folks are from, or even, you know, in the boreal forest area of Alberta, where he actually killed this bear. So, you know, I think the people that are in the middle, they get it. I mean, most of the people that I know that aren't even hunters would go, wow, the guy killed a black bear with a spear? Man, that's cool. What do you think, Josh?
Yeah, you know, I see Rocky's side of it on the way the bear was hunted, the reaction. I've been bear hunting, not in that type of situation. I have some good friends that live in the very northeastern corner of Georgia, up in the mountains, where baiting is illegal. So, you know, when we hunt them up there, it was spot and stalk type hunting with archery only. But the biggest majority of people, when they hunt bears, they hunted, you know, in that type of situation up north, over bait. And yeah, it can go, you know, a lot of what, you know, there's a lot of areas up there where deer are hunted, you know, kind of in the same way with, you know, alfalfa hay and stuff like that put out. And publicizing that can somewhat, you know, bring a negative light to things. You know, like I said, I think hunters just have to be careful with the way, because there's so many people. Yes, hunters are supporting hunters, but there's so many people, and not just in hunting, in everything in life, that are waiting for you to do one small thing, even if it's not necessarily wrong, just something that enough of them can disagree with to voice their opinion on. And, you know, I think that's what happened here. His celebration wasn't, you know, I don't think it was excessive. I mean, he's spent weeks and months preparing for this, and he capitalized on his opportunity. It's just it's unfortunate. I hate it for the guy and his wife. You know, it's just, you know, they've, and the media has just more or less crucified the guy, and it's just tough to watch. But, you know, as outdoorsmen, we can be, you know, a little more mindful at times of what we're doing, so that it makes more sense to people who, even if they don't want to hunt, they can say, well, man, those people, those hunters, fishermen, whatever, are out there. They're just doing what they love to do. You know, maybe on the weekends, you know, these people like to go, you know, whatever, go ball games, do whatever they want to do, and they enjoy it the same we enjoy our time. So, you know, the more positive light we can shed on it, I think the better. And I think, you know, as outdoorsmen as a whole, there's definitely times where maybe some lines get blurred in, is this a positive way to display it? But, you know, I hate to see it for the guy, but always be mindful of what you're putting out there, especially with the way social media and media is today.
Yeah, speaking of political correctness, you know, one of the things that happened at the end of the week of my beloved Ole Miss Rebels was, in politically correct world we live in, they finally took away one of the other parts of the traditions of Ole Miss, which was Dixie. Look, I'm not one of these, you know, crazy wild fans that looked at Dixie as my Southern heritage or anything like that. But I will say this, you know, I can remember as a kid laying on the hood of my truck with my dad listening to ball games on the radio, and you could hear Dixie coming through the radio at the ball game. So when I think of that, being a kid and looking back on it, you know, that's what I remember as a kid. Nothing, it had nothing to do with racism or Southern heritage or anything like that. And so I kind of hated to see that go away. I hated to lose that tradition at Ole Miss. And
yeah,
J. Paul, went to Ole Miss
for a couple of years and wound up transferring to Mizzou. But that makes me an alumni of Ole Miss. And I love Oxford. I loved the university. I can tell you, I was there in 1982 when could still carry the rebel flag, and I was there in 1983 when we couldn't. You know, and then I watched Johnny Reb go away, and now, you know, Dixie. And man, it bothers me.
The way that it was handled, let it go. It's fine. But why do you have to come out and make a big announcement to please the politically correct world? Hey, look at us. Look what we're doing. We're getting rid of it. Now you can like us. No, you know what's going to happen? They're just going to find something else wrong and something else to take away, like the name Ole Miss or the name Rebels. It's coming. If you're an Ole Miss fan and you're listening to this, I bet you $5 within 10 years the name Ole Miss will be gone. Get ready for it.
Oh, yeah. I can see it's going to be the University of Mississippi or Mississippi University. And, you know, we're going to have some politically correct mascot and the Rebels going to be gone. I mean, but, you know, what really stinks about this is, like I said, I was there in 82 when John Hawkins was, by the way, cheerleaders were elected back in 1982. I mean, it was, you know, there was an election held for that, and John Hopkins was a very popular, very articulate young black man who was elected cheerleader. And, you know, he said at the time that he didn't have any trouble with singing Dixie, by the way. He also said at the time he didn't have any trouble dressing up as Johnny Reb, because he acknowledged that there were, you know, Confederate soldiers who were black. The he didn't have a problem with the Confederate flag other than the standpoint of he was not going to run onto the field carrying one. He did not want to do that because to him personally, he felt like that it was used as a sign of racism in areas outside of the university. You know, he felt like that in the university, Johnny Reb as the mascot was no big deal. Singing Dixie was no big deal because they weren't racist symbols, either in or out of the university, but the Confederate flag was. You know, I get that. I can totally respect that. You know, but in our society, we just keep carrying things further and further because a year later, boom, the Confederate flag was gone. No one. And they came out in, I think, 84 with some really lame rebel rag idea. And then, you know, Johnny Reb, you know, eventually is gone by the wayside. And now Dixie? I mean, listen, I can play it on a duck call. When I hear Dixie, I think about the South. You know, I do not think about racism. I do not think about slavery. I think about my Southern heritage. And, man, I hate it. I mean, I absolutely hate it to see these traditions go away because in and of themselves, they're not racist. I get it that, you know, God wants us to all be respectful of one another, no matter, you know, our race, our religion, whatever. But we're taking tolerance to a level that's just totally extreme. And that brings us right back to the Bomars and the bear hunting incident. So the guy wants to, you know, go out there and hunt a bear with a spear, but we can't sing Dixie. I mean,
no, I'm right there with you. And like Rocky said, just the way that it's handled, it doesn't
just let it die silently.
That's right. It does not have to be that big of a deal. I mean, you know, if the Bomars, you know, if the hunting video would have, you know, circulated and it would have gone on like every other hunting video. I mean, how many videos, you know, are there out there and proof out there of people hunting and actually doing something wrong, but they're like, nah, whatever, that's not that big a deal. Same way.
Yeah, and that was my point.
I mean, there's so many things that deserve the attention that things like playing Dixie and legally and ethically killing a bear with a spear would just, they're so much more important than that. But it's never brought to light. You know, in my opinion, it's because, like I said, enough people decide, you know, that, hey, this is what we're going to be mad at today. So let's stick to it for a week or two and make sure we ruin a university or ruin somebody's life. And then when that's over with, we'll just find something else. We're really not going to be happy. We'll find something else. And that's what happens. That's what I've seen. Dang. I mean, especially the last 5 years, oh my gosh, it's just one thing after another, after another, after another. And it just gets old so fast, and it's so depressing. I mean, it's just like you can't do anything.
Yeah, and this is my point. I want to make this clear. You know, the guy to go out there and hunt with a spear, I think he's totally acceptable. That's his right. But, you know, the same people that say, hey, we've got to be respectful of other folks and we have to be tolerant, it's those same people that preach tolerance and that are the reason why we will not be singing Dixie during football games in Oxford this fall. It's those same people that preach that tolerance that are all over the Bomars family's butts about this. And that makes me angry and upset. Hey, I'll be singing Dixie. I'll be screaming hotty totty at every Ole Miss game that I go to for the rest of my life, no matter what. If somebody doesn't like that, hey, then you're not being tolerant of my rights. Anyway, I've said enough here.
But Jay Paul, Josh, I've got two questions from the Duck South users. One, both of you can answer, and then one is going to go straight to Jay Paul. The first question is, hey, guys, what would you suggest for a new duck camp that's just getting started? Do you have any suggestions that we can help these guys out with to start this new camp? Any suggestions on new rules?
Yeah, you know, on that side of things, something starting brand new and coming in. So obviously there's a group of guys that have gotten together and, you know, leased property, bought property, whatever it may be. And I think the first step And the biggest thing is communication. I think the first step of that is creating a weekend when everybody can be there, whether it's 5 of you, 10 of you. You know, I don't know how many people will be involved. But be there and understand that, you know, maybe this guy has two kids that he may want to bring sometimes. And that time with each other allows you to figure out kind of the dynamic of it, but it also allows everybody to understand how the hunting will work. So maybe they have 4 guys and maybe they have 10 blinds or whatever. So you have the time then to say, you know, to set up, you know, pressure and non-pressure areas. You have that time to communicate all of that so that there's not somebody working Monday through Friday thinking they're fixing to get to camp on the weekend and have a, you know, a good weekend of hunting only to find out that every blind out there has been hunted Monday through Friday when they get there. So I think that initial step of getting everybody there and having a good understanding of, you know, who can hunt during the week. Maybe you set, you know, certain days during the week, you know, that can and can't be hunted. But that communication, that initial step goes a long way, because you see a lot of times, you know, guys kind of filter in and out of camp and in and out of memberships, and they don't really know what's going on, so they just kind of do what they want. And that causes a lot of camps to break up and go their own ways and leave on really bad, leave on a really bad note. And that's again, just not, that's not what hunting's about, especially not a hunting camp. You know, I grew up in a hunting camp. I love it. You know, I've always loved that atmosphere. And it's just, it's great as long as everybody is willing to do their part and communicate and respect the guy next to them.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think that, you know, you've got to be respectful. That ought to be rule number one of any club, to be respectful of the other members. And as I get older and older, yeah, I totally agree with what Josh was saying. Being respectful and mindful of others, obviously, is paramount. You know, specifically, Rocky, as someone who has experience in this area, I'm the managing partner of a very large duck club in Northwest Tennessee, not membership-wise, but land-wise, although we do have 8 or 10 members to our club. But the two biggest suggestions that I could make to somebody starting based on my experiences, number one, put your rules down in writing. You know, it doesn't need to just be a verbal agreement or understanding. When you've got a set of rules, and they don't have to be elaborate, but when you've got a set of rules, basic rules, guidelines to go by, it's there in black and white. And so that takes away, you know, some confusion. Number two, there needs to be one person who is in charge. In the case of our duck club, I'm the managing partner. You know, the majority will rule on most things, but if, you know, the buck has to stop somewhere, it stops with me. And that's a common sense thing, because what that allows us to do is gives us a little bit of flexibility also within our rules. You know, at our particular club, we have 4 days a week that you can hunt, 3 days that you can't. We strongly believe that you've got to let that property rest in order for ducks to build up on it. But here's the thing. If nobody's hunted the farm for 2 or 3 days in a row that are out of our hunting days, let's say that, you know, Monday is a rest day and no one hunted the farm at all on Saturday and Sunday, two of the hunting days, and we've got an out-of-town member that doesn't get to make it often that's going to be able to come in and hunt Monday or Tuesday. Hey, you know, all he's got to do is give me a call, and I can, you know, make the judgment of whether common sense tells me that's a good exception or not. So, you know, put it in writing and have one person who is in charge. An army can't thrive if all it's got is generals. You know, there's got to be a leader. And then there's got to be the rest. And those are the things I would specifically suggest, Rocky.
I'll tell you, too, that I suggest real quick before we get to the training question. But the two that I suggest is make sure that whatever is designated as work days, I've seen camps break up over members not showing up for work days. If you can't show up for a work day, establish a rule that you have to pay so much into the coffer or the camp funds for not being able to show up for a work day. The other thing that I see as far as duck hunting camps go is kind of what you talked about, J. Paul, is having established hunting days. You, we don't go out here and hunt every day. We don't hunt every afternoon. We have established days, whether it be 2, 3, 4 days a week at the most. And those are the suggestions that I would put out there. But those are the two rules that I would suggest. But let's go into our second question before we bring John Hoffman on. Jay Paul, question from a Duck South user about dog training is, what is the number one mistake that you see new retriever owners make when it comes to training dogs?
Not preparing for hunting situations. Yeah, you know, got to be number one. I mean, we're coming right now into dove season and then teal season and then duck season. And it never ceases to amaze me the number of guys that go out hunting and their dog has never been shot over or the dog has never been exposed to a real bird, to feathers. I would suggest even live birds. You do not want the dog's first exposure to gunfire to be in the field. I said a couple of weeks ago that I think that opening day of dove season is probably the worst day of the year to introduce a new young dog to hunting. And I stand by that because doves are really small. If you've got a dog that's prone to have a mouth problem, he's going to have it with those little bitty birds. It's hot. There are usually a lot of people shooting. It's not easy for the dog to pick up the birds in the air. So, you know, it's a bad, bad idea. But just as bad an idea is to take a dog into a duck blind or, oh my goodness, into a pit, you know, into a steel pit blind, and the dog has never been shot over, and you got five guys at, you know, a legal shooting light, all jump up, unload 12-gauge shotguns right there in a steel pit with a dog that's never been shot over in the dog box. It's just a recipe for disaster. Same thing is true with feathers. I see guys that go out in the field and, you know, they call me up and they go, hey, man, first duck we shot, I could not get my dog to pick it up. And I'm like, well, okay, so, you know, how much have you had? And I'm talking about a dog we didn't train here. How much have you had your dog on birds? Oh, well, I don't have access to birds, so all I've been training with is dummies. Well, there you go. You know, you got a year-old dog that has never seen a duck. You can't expect them on their first hunting experience just to run out and pick up a dead one, much less one that's, you know, crippled and trying to get away from them. So I think the two biggest mistakes that amateurs make are, number one, not exposing their dogs to gunfire before hunting, and number two, not putting the dog on birds.
Thank you. Thank you for spending time answering that. This portion of the podcast is brought to you by TrainingWithJPaul.com. TrainingWithJPaul.com is a website that J. Paul has tons of content, videos, articles, all written especially for you as retriever owners to find great content to help you train your dog at home. If you ever have a question, you can go to AskJPaul.com. J. Paul is really fast about turning around these questions, and most likely we'll even film a video for you of answering that specific question you have. So again, it's TrainingWithJPaul.com.
Man, thanks, Rocky. I appreciate that. Hey, and I tell you what, had a great first half, but I neglected at the top of the podcast here to let everybody know that we are about to be joined here in just a few seconds by John Hoffman from Ducks Unlimited. Now, if you're a DU member, John is an extremely accomplished photographer. His photography is featured in every single one of the DU magazines, and one of John's jobs there at Ducks Unlimited at One Waterfowl Way there in Memphis, Tennessee, is to put together the magazine every month. But John also has an extensive knowledge about waterfowl and duck hunting. He's a very, very avid hunter himself, and so we're really fortunate to have him join us here on the podcast today. And John, I think I heard you. Come on. Are you with us, brother?
Yeah, I am. Good to be here. Thank you all for having me on the podcast today. I appreciate it.
Yes, sir, man. We're really, really glad to have you. And for those of you who are familiar with DU, you've definitely seen some of John's work in the magazine. And he puts it together every month. He is a very accomplished photographer. You'll see him with lots of photo credits, but you also wear a lot of different hats there at DU. What exactly is your job title, John?
My job title is photo editor, and I'm responsible for gathering all of the photography for the magazine, as well as shooting some photography for the magazine, both studio and environmental. Take a lot of product shots for each issue, and then I also shoot some in the field stuff, mostly of hunters, and I tend to try to lean more towards the action photography and try and get shells flying and birds coming into the decoys. And then I also handle imagery needs for the other departments at DU. There are, of course, a lot of other internal departments, membership, volunteer, corporate relations. All of these different departments put out promotional materials, flyers, pamphlets, and all of those pamphlets have a need for photography and imagery as well. So I assist the other departments and the website as well in any photo need that Ducks Unlimited needs or has.
Hey, John, I wanted to ask you on working with DU, I first wanted to ask how long you had been there, and if when you started with DU, did you start on the photography side, or were you a field staff expert side of it? How did you originally get your start and with DU?
That's a fun and interesting question, Rocky. I've been with DU for 12 years now, in February it'll be 12 years, so about 11 and a half years, and I've always been in the creative department, the creative services department. I've got a graphic design degree from the University of Tennessee at Martin. And when I was in college, I've always been an avid outdoorsman and went duck hunting with my dad the first time when I was probably 5 years old. So I've always been an avid outdoorsman. When I was in college starting to think about career paths, I wanted to somehow get in the hunting industry. I was getting a graphic design degree, and I just started cold calling different businesses in the industry and asking them if I could do an internship. I had to do an internship before I graduated, so I pressed hard with DU, and I ended up talking to their creative director, Doug Barnes, and I ended up doing a two-month internship with DU in college. I graduated college, and they didn't have a position open immediately, so I went to work for Avery Outdoors. I worked for Avery Outdoors as their photographer and creative director for about 3.5 years. And then DU had the photo editor position come up, and I also use a lot of my design background and my layout background in the magazine as well. I designed two or three of the features, and I'm in charge of designing the Green Wings portion of the magazine. So when that job came open, it was really a dream job for me, and I feel lucky to say that I enjoy going into work every day and feel confident in what I'm doing and feel like I'm working for a good organization.
Yeah, and you're doing great work too, let me tell you. I've been really impressed with your photography over the years. You just made the comment, you know, that you try to get the action shots, shells flying, birds dying, but you also get great action shots of the dogs. And obviously, as a dog trainer, I'm a little bit biased here, but I also know how difficult that is. And you seem to really do a good job of picking great dog shots and taking great retriever shots. Is that something you work really hard at?
It is. I'm a lot like you, Jay Paul. I love the dog stuff too, and that dog aspect of just hunting and having a companion there, and you know, having a workhorse that you can see going out and doing beautiful things in the field. So I love capturing retriever photography, and I'm fond to it as well. We have, you know, a lot of need for retriever photography in the magazine, and we work with over 100. Probably 130, 140 freelance photographers all over the world submit their photography to every issue of DU Magazine. So I'll send out a photo once list and tell them exactly what we're needing, and then they'll send in submissions, and I will edit through all those submissions and compile packages for each article and each column in the magazine, and of course we have a standing retriever column that we highlight a lot of retriever photography in, and it's a great place to showcase some of the better retriever photography we get, because we're really fortunate to have some of the best photographers in the freelance industry and the outdoors industry that still submit every issue to DU Magazine. So I feel like we do have a unique opportunity to showcase some of the best retriever photography that's out there.
John, I know that a minute ago you mentioned that you also kind of under one of your many hats you put together the green wing part of what DU does. Can you speak to how important that part of Ducks Unlimited's organization is to the future of our hunting? I know some people that are closely involved with the green wings, where they live, and I know what it means to them, but I think for all the listeners, it's important to know from the inside DU side how passionate y'all are about that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been great to see organizationally that really in the last several years, DU has put more and more focus into the youth initiative, and we have recently started some really interesting and fun programs that are called DU varsity programs and DU high school programs, and that is high school and college chapters throughout the country starting DU events and DU chapters at the high school and then collegiate level. So that's been great to see come together, and our youth version of the magazine is called the Green Wings issue. So that goes out to all of the Green Wings members that are 13 to 18 years old. The Green Wing members that are under 13 years old are referred to as junior Green Wings, and they receive the Puddler magazine, which is a totally different publication that I also helped put the photography together for. But the Green Wing, senior Green Wing version of the magazine has a whole section in the middle of the magazine where the institutional DU fundraising stuff is replaced with about 8 to 10 pages of specific youth content and articles focused on what youth would be interested in. So DU here recently has put a whole lot of effort into supporting the Green Wing initiative, and that in turn is the youth initiative, and that's what all of us as outdoorsmen and want to look forward to promoting, and everyone wants to be able to share the experiences with their kids and the next generations that they've experienced. So, absolutely, I think everyone would agree that the youth initiative is important throughout our outdoor and hunting industry, and probably now more so than ever.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I've been very impressed with the varsity program. I think it started in the colleges and then moved down into the high schools. My daughter, who is a junior in high school, was part of one of the very first high school varsity chapters that we established here at Dyersburg High School in Dyersburg, Tennessee. And the turnout that we've had has been amazing. These kids, a lot of them didn't know a whole lot about duck hunting, and they're getting into it. And so I would encourage anybody out there who's a listener to, particularly if you've got kids that are middle school, high school age, find out if there's a varsity chapter in your area at your high school. If there's not, get one started. In our case, Jimbo Robinson, the regional director for our area, came up with instrumental. I mean, Jimbo in West Tennessee has put so much effort, John, it looks like, in getting these varsity chapters started. And these young people definitely are the future for us. And so, man, I think you guys are doing a terrific job there. And I hope that everybody listening, if you've got a kid, take a look at the DU varsity program, because it is our future.
Yeah, absolutely. That's how we feel. And we certainly have seen it grow, and it's fun to see youth get excited about the outdoors and shooting sports. And more you see high school trap teams, popping up across the country. So I know Dyersburg was one of the first and probably one of the best examples here in West Tennessee of a high school chapter getting started and really getting a lot of momentum behind it. So it's great to see when that happens.
Yeah, they really have built up. I got to speak to that group And I've actually spoken to several of these. And that brings me to my next question, because when I'm there at these DU varsity meetings as a speaker, the most frequently asked question that I get is, what's the best duck hunt that you've ever been on? So I want to turn the tables on you now here, John, and ask you that. Either as a photographer, let's take it from that angle. What's the best duck hunt that you've ever been on?
It would probably have to be down in South Louisiana. I was down there 4 years ago on a story with the magazine about a family, generational family that had been hunting in South Louisiana for as long as they'd been there. And it was a grandfather, great-grandfather, grandson, and great-grandson all on the hunt. And it was really special because not only was it just neat seeing all them connect and seeing all them have a great hunt, but the birds were unbelievable. The light was unbelievable. They limited out in 20 or 30 minutes. They ended up shooting a pair of mottled ducks that was really cool, and they shot a black duck down there on the same hunt that they very rarely shoot. So it was kind of one of the hunts that was really stuck out in my mind because I was getting to take pictures of the hunt, seeing the camaraderie between them, the four generations of hunters there and family, and then the hunting on top of all that was spectacular as well. So that hunt definitely sticks out in my mind. And having grown up in West Tennessee, we were out there in T-shirts, and, you know, it was like 80 degrees, so that was kind of nice too.
Yeah, it's always great when you can get out there and be in shirt sleeves, particularly as a photographer. It's kind of hard to take pictures with big old fat gloves on your hands, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. That particular hunt, there were flocks of 50 and 60 teal coming in, and the guys were coming up and shooting on them, and it was just all kinds of action going on, and it was a great hunt, great photography that turned out and got to feature a lot of it in the magazine.
Well, one more question for you here on those lines, too. Would you rather have a shotgun in your hands on a great hunt or have a camera in your hand?
That's tough. I've tried to do both, and it's almost impossible. But most of the time, I would rather have a camera. You know, just recording the memories is so special, and I can capture that moment in time and share that with other people who have never seen it before, and that in itself is something special. So I love shooting just as much as anybody else, but here recently, I've been finding myself pick up the camera a lot more often, and I've enjoyed it just as much.
I think on that note, it really proves to the point where a lot of the times the best wildlife photography is done by someone who's a hunter first, more or less, not just someone who sees, well, maybe I can, you know, slip out there and take some pictures of ducks or deer or whatever. I think being a hunter and knowing what situation to be in, you know, what might or might not happen on a hunt, where to put yourself, I think that plays really, really big into getting those shots that someone, say, you know, just a photographer who wants to go out and try it might not get. You agree with that, John?
Absolutely. You know, I think that's one part of the photography for me that is almost just exciting or as exciting as the hunting is, you really have to know what you're doing. You really have to plan for all the things that you would in a hunting scenario, wind, weather, sunlight, you know, all of these things that you would be thinking about in a hunting scenario, you have to plan for in photography as well. I had a humbling experience 3 or 4 years ago, the first time I went out on a real waterfowl, real duck concentrated photo shoot for DU Magazine. And we went to the Rainwater Basin in Nebraska, and we had ghillie suits and muskrat huts. And, you know, I'm talking about everything that you would need to conceal. And a couple of days we still got burnt because we didn't play the wind right, or we got the wind just right and the sun came up right in our eyes, which is, of course, terrible for photography. So all of the aspects, or a lot of the aspects that you would think about and concentrate on in hunting, you have to put the same efforts into to get good wildlife photography. I mean, you've got to be close. You've got to be hidden. You got to try and catch the birds in their natural environments, and you know, doing natural things while they're feeding and in flight. And courtship flights are so neat, but because they're so pretty. But you really have to get in there and have a hunter's mindset to get good waterfowl photography, and that is definitely one of the aspects that I enjoy about it so much.
Yeah, but being humble, you also left out something there that is a key ingredient, and that you got to have the eye for it too. I mean, you can be in the best spot, you can have the setup absolutely right, but if you do not have an eye for what you need to capture, if you can't see it and shoot it and know it, then you know, you're only going to be good. You're never going to be great. And I think that's one of the things, you know, guys like you and Bill Buckley and Clay Connor, you know, you have an eye. My buddy Jake Latondres, you guys have an eye for it. And that just blows my mind how you can visualize it before you even snap the shutter on it and know this is something that I need to get. And I think that's pretty strong.
Yeah, that's definitely a part of it. It's a fun part for me with I don't necessarily have a photography background. I've had, you know, some photography classes in my graphic design training degree, in my college degree in graphic design. I had some photography classes, but since then I've concentrated more and more and learned more about it. But I am always thinking about the shot before I take the shot because of my design background. I'm thinking, how will this set up on the spread? Well, how will this, you know, is this a cover shot? It needs to be vertical. You have to think about all that and kind of play out everything before you even press the button on the shutter. And that's you're right. That's what separates the good from the amateur is, you know, you've got to have the shot in mind and then be able to convey that over and bring it through in unbelievable photography and imagery that inspires people.
Well, I got to say, you do a great job at that. You know, I probably, every single issue, thumb through it at least two or three times. Just looking at the photography, you know, after doing TV for so long, I have a real appreciation for you guys that have skill in that. And one of the things that really sets the Ducks Unlimited magazine apart is the fact that the photography that you have in there is absolutely world class. And I know you've got a whole bunch of guys to draw from, but I know you also contribute a whole lot to that yourself, John. And man, listen, we've got to begin to wrap it up here, but we've really enjoyed having you this Sunday afternoon as our guest. Now, this is a portion of our program, John, here where before we close it out, we kind of take a final question or final thought from our co-host here. So we're about to turn them back over, and they're each going to have something for you, I hope. But before we do, everybody, our guest this week, John Hoffman, Ducks Unlimited. This portion of our broadcast is brought to you by Bear Animal Health Advantage Multi, the only heartworm preventative that is 100% effective at preventing heartworms. Okay, guys, Josh, you first. Final question for John or final thoughts?
Yeah, I just have one last question because it's something that goes through every duck hunter's mind when they sit down and talk or hunt together. And so while we have you here, photographer or hunter, doesn't matter. I know you always have a blind bag. If you reach in it, what snack are you going to pull out? We've got to get that out of.
I'm going with the Christmas cake. They only bring them out. They got a new one last year, red velvet Christmas cake with the cream filling.
Yeah, that's a special time of year, not only because we're able to hunt, but because of the Christmas cake. So I agree with you there. So, but look, it's been great having you. I've enjoyed it, and I thank you for all you do for everybody, not just EU, but for everybody. Yeah, there's so much. You can see your passion in what you do, and I appreciate it from all of us here at Duck South.
Thanks again, Josh. I appreciate y'all having me. It's been great talking to you guys this afternoon, and hope everybody has a good season.
Man, we're looking forward to it, but we've still got Rocky LaFleur. Okay, Rocky.
John, as a lifelong thumber of the Ducks Unlimited magazine, man, the appreciation for what you do can't be expressed through this podcast. I'm like J. Paul. I love to look. I'm a reader now. I love reading the great articles that are in the Ducks Unlimited magazine, but the photography that is there and capturing those moments, man, what you do is unbelievable. Thank you for taking the time on a Sunday afternoon to join us for this podcast. Really, really appreciate it.
Absolutely, Rocky. I appreciate y'all giving me the opportunity to talk a little bit about what I do and some of what DU does. And I'm like you guys, you know, I love it. I grew up doing it, and it's all about the Ducks. So thanks for you guys and what y'all do, and I hope everybody has a good season.
Yes, sir, John. We really do appreciate it. Look, brother, I'm going to tell you now, we're going to be calling on you some more. This isn't just a one-and-done deal. I think that most of our listeners, most of our Duck South members are involved in Ducks Unlimited, and we're all very interested to hear not only about what you do, but what DU as an organization has going on. So I'm going to be calling on you a whole lot, Rocky and Josh and Houston and I are in the future to come back and be part of this broadcast again.
Okay. Sounds great, man. I appreciate it, Jack Paul. And I enjoy talking to you guys.
Yes, sir, buddy. You have a great day, John.
Okay, you too.
Okay, folks, that wraps up our Sunday afternoon edition of the On the X podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com. Today we were brought to you by Excel Boats and Mud Buddy Motors. Excel Boats and Mud Buddy Motors, they believe there is no such thing as overbuilt. Well, guys, man, it was great being on here with you today. I'm fixing to get out my dictionary and look up what a thumber of a magazine is, Rocky, unless you can clarify that for me now.
Which where you just thumb through it, just looking. And then you go back and you actually take time and read the articles.
I hear you. I would be a thumber. Like I said, I thumb through it two or three times just looking at the pictures. I'm glad that you cleared that up for us.
Hey, J. Paul, one thing that I, you know, want to get across, look, we here at the On the X podcast, we support all of these nonprofit organizations that make hunting better. Ducks Unlimited, Delta Waterfowl, NWTF, any organization that gets hunters in the woods and makes hunting better, we support every one of them. We're glad to have somebody great like John on the podcast with us, you know, to talk about a little bit about what Ducks Unlimited does, but also his great work in the magazine, because he is a humble guy.
Yes, he is, and one of the best out there. Well, guys, that does it for us. Thanks so much for tuning in to the Sunday afternoon edition of the On the X podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.